Welcome to the first Commentary Magazine podcast of the year 2017. Today is January 3rd. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary. And with me, as always, Noah C. Rothman, our assistant online editor, manning the board, and Abe Greenwald, our senior editor, manning the post-it notepad sitting right in front of him. I hope everyone had a wonderful holiday week. I was in London myself with my family, which is maybe the world's greatest vacation. And I commend it to anybody who hasn't been there lately. Unfortunately, others here were sick, suffering Christmas flu, and apparently that was a common thing going around America. So I apologize to everybody who might be suffering. If you are listening to this podcast and you are not yet a subscriber to Commentary Magazine, I've got a special offer for you, special New Year's offer. So go to commentarymagazine.com, click on subscribe, and you will, if you enter the coupon code 2017, you can get a annual digital subscription for $14.95 instead of the usual $19.95, and an all-access subscription, which includes our beautiful monthly magazine, for $24.95 instead of $29.95. That's commentarymagazine.com. Click on subscribe and enter the coupon code 2017. So, gentlemen, we had an interesting kerfuffle that started last night around 10 p.m. when the New York Times reported that the incoming new Republican Congress had decided as its first act and over the objections of its leadership to eliminate the Office of Congressional Ethics and a supposedly independent body whistleblowing, able to listen to whistleblowers and sort of do something about potential congressional misconduct and fold its duties into the ethics committee, but denying it any press officer or right to speak to the press or anything like that. And the net result of this was a press outcry, lots of phone calls to congressional offices, a tweet from President-elect Trump that seemed to divorce him from the Congress's actions and call into question the validity of those actions, and the move was tabled, all in the space of about 14 hours. So what do you think, Noah Rothman, we can learn from what happened in this strange little moment of peculiar congressional reform?
Well, I think you probably have some more interesting, far-reaching lessons to glean from this than I do. But what I was struck by when this happened was how little of the, you know, natural gravitational force of partisanship was exerted on the right. I mean, there was kind of something almost like a legitimate grievance here that necessitated this. The idea that the OCE is a partisan body, that it's got individuals in it who leak information to the press in order to get sort of vigilante justice against individuals in particularly in Republican membership. They're irate over this body. They think that it's unduly focused on them, that it costs them a lot of money to pursue litigation, to get their good names back after these sort of things leak, even though sometimes when they leak, it's for a good reason. It actually does some really good work in enforcing discipline on these memberships. So they had a good sort of cause there that they could have made a case for. The fact that they hadn't made a case before they actually made this maneuver probably precipitated the just uniform outcry over it, including among members of the conservative commentariat. And that, including what we understand to be a deluge of calls into congressional offices and some backlash from leadership, which had warned against this maneuver but was ignored, resulted in it being tabled and overturned. I think that was probably the most fascinating for me. And again, you have different lessons to learn from this, but the fact that the obvious politically negative optics associated with this compelled people who found this to be a dumb hill to die on to abandon it.
Right. Well, Abe Greenwald, do you think that the incoming Republican Congress may have believed that there was some latitude for it to behave somewhat brazenly in the pursuit of its own interests because of the dynamic introduced into American politics in 2016 by Donald Trump's brazenness, the willingness to sort of go in the face of what would seem to be ordinary congressional rules or ordinary political rules by just doing it and then daring people to, you know, be outraged?
Yeah, I think the interesting thing about that is I think they probably did think that, and others, onlookers, thought that as well, because this morning I saw on I was watching Morning Joe, and the press were sort of covering this as a sort of expression of Trump sensibility. There was someone said something to the effect of, well, if the guy at the top isn't following the rules and is sort of writing his own rules, then who is anyone beneath him or near him to do otherwise? And then, of course, he came out and seemingly against type, tweeted in a sort of non-disruptive, calming way. Whether or not that had any actual effect on the fact that this was reversed or not is debatable.
Well, I think the lesson here is that certain things are non-transferable. I mean, Donald Trump got, you know, 46% of the vote. He won 30 states. He won 306 electoral votes or 304 electoral votes. And what he gets and who he is and his latitude simply will not translate to any other Republican in the country, particularly not to Republican members of Congress or the Republican caucus in Congress. Congress remains extraordinarily unpopular. You have a press that is almost uniformly hostile to Republicans and will be extremely hostile to Trump, but certainly hostile to congressional Republicans, and will jump on any and every possible piece of malfeasance or seemingly bad behavior to delegitimize the uniform Republican power in the executive and legislative branches. And the idea that somehow you can get a buy because it's the Trump era has now, in literally in the first, before this Congress was even sworn in, has already been invalidated. And in fact, they better be really careful, because if Trump has Teflon, that is to say, if it's very hard for the press or Democrats or people who really don't like Trump to get at him, the incentives to go nuclear on every act of Congress, every hearing, every slip of the tongue by any congressman, staffer, anything like that, just goes through the roof. Like that becomes a much easier way to get at Republicans than going after Trump himself. And, you know, this is the Caesar's wife situation. Like, Trump can do whatever he wants. They better be purer than pure, or they are going to be in a world of trouble.
I predict that they won't be purer than pure, at least not for some time. I mean, it's still, even though it's been invalidated today, I think mischief is still very much in the air, and it's going to be hard for them to resist. By the way, I think it's going to be sort of hard for both sides to resist. I mean, everything has been ratcheted up. There's sort of like this sort of arms race of action going on now.
Also, there's this impulse that I don't know if it's really well placed to give Trump credit for a lot of things that occur that are attributable to other forces in the political universe and in the economic universe. The fact that, you know, you have Morning Joe supposedly saying, well, you know, that Donald Trump tweeted and cut the legs out from under Republicans. Well, that's true. It's certainly true. But that probably obscures the impact that, for example, leadership played in this situation. And I think they probably emerge a little bit more strengthened. And now we're not really putting a lot of focus on leadership, but they probably deserve more of it than they're getting. And then that'll obscure the fact that when something else happens that's attributable to leadership, we won't be looking in the right place. So that's sort of a myopia focused on Trump that he might not deserve.
But, you know, it's interesting. You know, if he's smart about this, he can see how much he can benefit by doing so little. you know, if he simply comes out on the saner side of any given issue, or the, or what's perceived as the saner side of any given issue, because of expectations, he will get tremendous credit. Well,
I just don't think this was a hard call for him or anybody. The look of Republicans trying to take the teeth out of efforts to ensure that Congress behaves ethically and is just so terrible that Trump, the Mr. Drain the Swamp, doesn't really have to do very much except say, I don't like the look of that.
Well, all he did, though.
That's all he did.
It wasn't a full-throated condemnation.
No, it was actually very sober. You know, it was these two tweets, and he basically said, if they have legitimate grievances, this isn't the way to go about it, right? We need to take up more important things right now. And apparently, House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy, the number two guy in the House leadership, said at a closed-door session of the House Republicans this morning, who here ran on issues relating to the Office of Congressional Ethics as opposed to Obamacare and tax reform? And the room went silent. Because, of course, if they have legitimate grievances, if their fear is that this office can be used as a partisan weapon against them, then fine. If those fears, as they say, they can be articulated, and they run the Congress now, and they've run the Congress for a long time. I don't understand how this office somehow is uniquely hostile to Republicans if it's under the aegis of a House of Representatives that's run by the Republican Party. That doesn't make a lot of sense. The Republicans have run the House since the end of, the beginning of 2011. That's 6 years. Like, I don't know how an institutional bias office that was set up in 2008 couldn't have been, dealt with more harshly or directly. So I think that's the problem there. And as I say, I think that was a gimme. But I do think that some lessons can be learned from this for Republicans in Congress, which is that, it is open season on them, and that's why they wanted to denude this office of its power. But they're not threatened by this office. They are threatened by the political realities of the situation. Democrats are off kilter. They don't know how to attack Trump. They don't understand the basis or the source of Trump's power and authority. They don't understand where his weaknesses are yet. They thought his weaknesses were his weaknesses, and some of those turned out to be strengths. They will figure this out over time. I mean, this is not – everybody always has the fallacy of thinking that, the current situation will never change. And, Trump's vulnerabilities and the way to get at him and to start harming his making him more unpopular and less powerful will start becoming clear over time. But they need to be in reaction to things that he does and things that he says, and the fact that he will have promised things that he can't deliver, and Democrats are very able and serious political players. They got a lot of money. They'll have a lot of money to spend to test messages to go after him and figure out where those vulnerabilities are, and they'll work it.
Well, this raises a question. Did Republicans ever figure out Obama's vulnerabilities and exploit them?
Well, they certainly figured out the Democratic Party's vulnerabilities over time, and certainly the Tea Party uprising was a direct understanding of. I wouldn't say that they figured out Obama's vulnerabilities. It was an expression of government is getting too big and spending way too much money, and we are, empowering people who have no sense of personal responsibility over people who are like paying their bills and trying to, make their way through this horrible economic situation, and they're nationalizing healthcare and the auto industry and all of that. And Congress, the House was taken and this giant shellacking. And then obviously in 2014, they figured out that by pushing him on certain types of things, people sort of forget. So 2014, there was the summer. It was the summer of crisis with ISIS and the kids on the border, and it was Obama's "Everything's fine, don't worry about it. It's a JV team, and don't think this is a crisis. Nothing's a crisis. Nothing's a crisis." And the public didn't think that nothing was a crisis. So I don't know if that's exploiting his vulnerabilities, or if that's just a sort of natural outgrowth of the response to incompetent or bad governance.
It's also a kind of jujitsu, because that was that sort of calm mean was considered his great asset, that he was that he was so even.
I think the Republicans benefited inadvertently every single time, because they thought that they had the political wind at their backs, and they did, but it was sort of just a response again to Obama. It was a lot of disaffected Democrats and independents in 2010 who voted for who were Tea Party populists, not conservatives. As you say, in 2014, the same thing happened. A lot of frustrated and scared individuals voted against Barack Obama in absentia. And in 2016, you had a populist uprising that was fueled by a lot of formerly Democratic voting members of the electorate who supported a Republican, in some cases for the first time ever. And this is sort of something that benefited Republicans against the Republicans' own efforts. It's like, not like Republicans were courting Democrats and independents at all these years. In fact, they thought they had a mandate for conservative reforms when they probably didn't. So, will Donald Trump face a similar condition where Republicans are forced out of the Republican coalition and land into the Democratic camp by default?
Well, it's hard to imagine that, but it is certainly easy to imagine the overreading of the Trump mandate. Everyone's talking about, does Trump have a mandate? Doesn't he? Didn't win the popular vote, all of that. Have mandates ever existed? But it is certainly easy to see, which is, I think, what Kevin McCarthy's point was in yelling at the members of his caucus, that winning victories in elections doesn't then mean that you're handed the keys to everything and can do whatever you want. You're still a person in a representative circumstance, and the public can express its opinion. And if you overreach, and you force things through without thinking about what the practical effect could be in the long term, you could find yourself in a catastrophic situation. You could see a narrative developing, had this gone through, where you say, from the very first day that the Republicans took power in the House, 2 weeks before Trump was even inaugurated, they were setting up the conditions under which they were supposed to be impregnable. The corruption was not just the potential economic corruption of the Trump business, conflicts of interest, but was the political corruption of Republicans trying to solidify their control by making it impossible for them ever to be investigated on ethics matters. And that could be a very strong line of argument to take into a midterm election, and by cutting that off at the knees, something very salutary happened to Republicans. The question is, will they understand that lesson, or will they do what they often do and what Democrats do and what everybody does, which is overreach and think that the election is about issues that it was not about? Will they classically social issues, will they push certain types of social issues that are of not much interest to the voters who elected Trump and gave Republicans this unitary control over two of the three branches of the government?
You also actually had that's actually a point that Michael Brandon Doherty, a columnist over at The Week, had made earlier. It was a very important point, that a lot of the people in Trump's administration are conservatives of an activist sort of ilk, and may find themselves in quagmires of their own making that they could have otherwise easily avoided. But you had a better point earlier that I don't want to forget, because you had noted that nobody had this in their scorecards when they were looking at the future of 2017, and these sort of things just happen, and they derail the conversation.
Well, all the time. That's the nature of politics. The nature of politics isn't that you have a nice orderly, first you do this, and then you do that, and then you develop support, you build coalitions. Unexpected news events are the order of the day in politics. Somebody says something stupid and it, lights the country on fire for a couple of days. Obama says something stupid about Skip Gates getting arrested in Cambridge, and suddenly for like 5 days the country is talking about whether or not, Obama is hostile to the police, which he certainly didn't need at the time that happened. It was very helpful, by the way, to the gathering clouds of the Tea Party, to help solidify the gathering sense of the Tea Party that Obama was hostile to ordinary people and was only interested in you know, elites and not to cops and like that.
Yeah, these 24-hour or even week-long stories, they have real reverberations that last.
Yeah, and they come out of nowhere. They're by definition unpredictable, you know, and then there are unpredictable events. Throughout the Obama presidency, there were unpredictable events that, you know, you can hardly believe came up out of nowhere. You know, the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, right, which Obama had no responsibility for, but nonetheless, there's oil pouring into the Gulf and killing birds and doing all that, you know, just 6 or 8 weeks before the 2010 midterms, and then you have or Ebola, or the whole thing with Ebola and the response to Ebola. I mean, those are major news stories, you know. And okay, so fine, there wasn't a big old Ebola outbreak in the United States, and turned out Ebola wasn't as contagious as people thought it was and all of that. But, you know, remember how terrified everybody was of Ebola? Well, you think we're not going to have an Ebola? We just had a Office of Congressional Ethics scandal for a day that if had the reversal not happened, we would be talking about for weeks. And that is the nature of politics. White houses and political organizations are constantly laying things out in terms of we're going to have healthcare week this week, and then we're going to have entitlement reform week, and then we're going to have this, and we'll have recovery summer, and then we'll have infelicity autumn, and we'll have the winter, you know, and as though you can control the calendar.
But that was the George W. Bush administration's transition policies. They had various, you know, week-to-week rollouts contrasted mightily with the Clinton transition process, which was a complete mess. They were defined by infighting. They didn't have any sort of policy, 100-day policy layout, and which presidency is defined as, you know, by posterity as the more well-liked, I suppose. You know, it's not the Bush administration.
Well, I mean, again, order is all well and good, except you can't. You just can't depend on it. You know, a lot of what political leadership is responding to the unexpected and whether people have a taste for it and have a feel for it. You know, downing of the Chinese plane the first couple of weeks of the Bush administration, you know, stuff like that. You know, you just don't know where it's going to come from. And, of course, that is the real test of Trump, who has literally no experience having to respond to these kinds of crises as a congressman, as a governor, as a senator, as a state representative, as anything, you know, just.
I would submit, by the way, that this communicating with the electorate via tweet is going to be wholly insufficient when that crisis occurs, when he's faced with an actual news cycle that gets away from him. He's going to find that his interaction with the universe via 140 characters is woefully insufficient to meet the moment.
It would be the opposite, I would say, that you could imagine how the tweeting could become more anodyne and helpful in the sense that he could use it to introduce sweetness and light into things as opposed to simply combativeness, like a nice tweet about an Al Roker Willard Scott tweet about a lady's 100th birthday, you know, something like that. So basically anything that he tweets will have 5 million readers. You know, he's mastered the form sufficiently so that, you know, you can catch flies with honey as well as, you know, as well as being, you know, wildly combative.
But they don't have a life cycle, the lifespan to them. I'm just to make this point that if the news cycle had really truly gotten away from him and he was under the gun, and it was a real controversial news cycle. Those tweets that we talk about today, that we impart a whole lot of weight and influence and gravity to them, they don't have a very long life cycle before we have to move on.
But here's how he could do this forever and have it serve his interests. He's his own Spiro Agnew, by which I mean that, you know, Nixon used Spiro Agnew as an attack dog going after the media, you know, speeches written by William Safire, talking about how terrible the media was. So he could use Twitter to just pick fights with the press all the time, or yell at the press, or complain about stories and in unjust stories. And every time he does that, they will respond in a Pavlovian fashion. They will salivate. They will bark. They will yell. They'll want to, you know, talk about it incessantly. And conservatives in particular, who hate the media, will feel as though, you know, he has their back, and he's representing them in their general disgust with the media's use of its own power to, you know, further its own liberal agenda and all of that. That's one possibility to look at how Twitter can be useful to him, basically by constantly using the press as a, you know, as he's Muhammad Ali and the press is Chuck Wepner, you know, the guy who was the model for Rocky, you know, just press is a punching bag.
Right.
And it doesn't even know it's a punching bag. It's like, how can he? Going after the First Amendment. I mean, you can't say that about Glenn Thrush of the New York Times, why he's a fine reporter, you know, that kind of stuff. And the minute that they get into that, this isn't normal, you know, that whole thing. You're normalizing him. How can normalize him if you treat this as though it's acceptable, you know?
Well, I think, I mean, the real problem is when he tweets on serious matters, when he's not sort of just defending himself to the press. And he uses Twitter so frequently to remain vague on an issue, to sort of confuse and keep you guessing. You know, recently there was this news broke that North Korea would be testing a missile that may or may not be able to reach the west coast of the United States. And Trump tweeted something to the effect of "not going to happen." What does that mean? What does that mean? Not going to happen? Are you? Is that some sort of threat? Are you going to stop it? Are you not going to stop? Or are you just saying that they're going to be unable to do that? Now he's not going to be able to do that as president.
Do whatever he wants.
But that's the absence of crisis. I mean, we're not in the middle of a news cycle defined by a crisis on the Korean Peninsula. This is just happening. He's created that story from scratch, and he's defining the course of that news cycle with this tweet. If he's forced to respond to events, I think it might be a different situation.
Right. Well, it's also this question of whether or not his the solipsism, what role the solipsism and self-involvement plays. You know, is he going to do this to conduct petty, prideful fights with people where he's punching way down, you know, Alec Ball, you know, some imitation of him he doesn't like, or a joke that, you know, that John Oliver tells on HBO. Well, who, I don't know. Something somebody says on Morning Joe that annoys him. Now,
The CNN book with his picture,
because he's upset with the look of the cover photo of the CNN book, which is called Unprecedented or something like that, the one about the election. I mean, whatever he does, he can do, and we'll see. And the whole thing is that one can assume that it is all improvised. And then the question is, this is the thing we don't know. How improvised an administration is this going to be? Administrations find, presidents find, that it's extremely hard for them not to do everything in a very studied manner because they can't control what's going on around them unless they do it in that fashion. You know, they don't speak off the cuff because it's more trouble than it's worth to speak off the cuff. That's why they don't give press conferences, and they don't want to be themselves, because when they're themselves, they say things like, you know, cops shouldn't do something stupid, and then you get in a week of the Skip Gates story. I think Obama thinks that was a well-spent use of his time, and then ending up having a beer with Gates and the cop. I mean, that was not helpful to him. And so you dial it back, and you get more controlled and more considered. And I imagine that will happen with Trump just inevitably, because people are self-protected. They essentially have a sense of a core of self-protection and don't want to, they don't want to, like, get themselves into trouble for no reason unless you're really working out something deep psychologically, like Bill Clinton, who I think got himself into trouble to get himself out of trouble because he was bored. You know, he didn't know that it was not a smart thing to do to, like, make time with an intern at the White House, and that he wasn't, like, risking something terrible by doing it. Of course he did. He did it on purpose to raise the stakes, you know, sort of classic sociopath behavior. You don't feel anything, so you have to push buttons and raise the stakes and live dangerously. And maybe that's Trump too. Who knows? The other thing that's going on is the behavior of the Obama administration as it comes to a close. Right. So we have this specter of the administration having said that it wanted to have a quiet and calm and respectable transition of power, peaceful is instead attempting to create fait accompli and facts on the ground in policy after policy to make things difficult for the Trump administration as it attempts to reverse some of the practical policies of the Obama administration. Some of them are really kind of bizarre, I think. Some of them are, I think, awful just on the surface, like the UN vote against Israel and the preposterous John Kerry speech on Israel. And then some of them are just bizarre, like this thing about not about drilling, ocean and Arctic drilling, and that somehow, even though it wasn't voted on by Congress, by declaring these fields off limits and this area off limits, this has the force of law under a 1951 statute and can't be reversed, which of course is ridiculous because Trump will announce that he will deem it reversed, and then the question is whether the permanent bureaucracy will actually listen to him or try somehow to do an end around that. But we're having a dispute here about whether or not this is standard issue conduct for administrations in transition, particularly if they're going to another party, or whether something really new and different is going on here. Noah, what's your...
Yeah, well, I think that the transition has been pretty unseemly. Particularly compared to the last transition. We had the Bush administration's transition to the Obama administration, perhaps fueled by the fact that the Bush administration was well aware that it was not a popular asset. And the Obama administration doesn't have that same sense. Barack Obama is going out with a 55% plus approval rating, something like that. So I think he believes himself to be a little bit above reproach here. But the Bush administration was very deferential to the president-elect's wishes. They handed him control over the remainder of TARP money by January with congressional consent. And that was, dubbed a real, feat. Here, by contrast, we have outright hostile expressions of contempt for what Barack Obama is doing in terms of executive actions, in terms of contending that he himself would probably have won the election, whereas Hillary Clinton lost. Kellyanne Conway suggesting that Barack Obama doesn't love his country enough, using her words, to have an orderly transition. And then some actions which I think are actually taking some options off the table for the president-elect, which I'm not necessarily frustrated by themselves, because I don't necessarily disagree with the policy, but I do worry about the precedent, and particularly in regard to the idea that we're going to have some sort of a hostile interaction with Russia in these final days of the Obama administration. That I feel like is spurred on not by the result of actions on the ground or new news, but by frustrated Democrats leaning on the president to exact some sort of retribution for what they believe was interference with the election, to a point I think that a lot of Democrats actually believe that it turned the election. And they are, as such, are engaging in, the White House is engaging in overt and covert actions against Russia that will typify and color diplomacy in the Trump administration. You can start hostile actions with Russia much easier than you can roll them back, and the Trump administration will inherit some of these ongoing operations, and it will perhaps try to roll them back. But that's easier said than done. And to the extent that Moscow might feel reciprocity is due, that will typify bilateral relations in the Trump administration.
Abe?
Well, I wonder if Obama didn't have a very late rethink on this Russia issue. Because if you recall, in the press conference he gave before he went on his vacation, he said something like, this wasn't a grand conspiracy. And I told Putin to knock it off, and then he did, and he sort of vaguely sort of blamed the press for spreading it as being a larger deal than it was almost, and then next thing you know, it's a few days later, and he's expelling 25 Russians.
That goes to the point, because he was on like muscle relaxers at that press conference. Right, Democrats had a real problem. With
I think
his
he started smarting. Yes, I think you're right.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I think it's very hard to know what the institutional prerogatives or the institutional pressures were once the intelligence community decided that Russia you know, had been this great villain, although we'd been told that Russia had done this, you know, that Obama had known about this in July and decided not to act. And why did he decide not to act? Because he thought Hillary was going to win. So it was all, you know, silliness and, you know, Putin being absurd and futzing around and being silly, and the American people would put a stop to that. I mean, no one here at this table believes that Putin isn't anything but a bad actor on the world stage, and that the United States shouldn't be confronting his bad actions, not just in cyberspace, but you know, on the real ground with serious you know, countermeasures. But I don't think what Obama's doing are serious countermeasures, in the sense that since they have a date list, since they basically expire. You're saying that he's setting – Noah, you're saying he's sort of setting things in motion that Trump can't pull back. But obviously, there's an expiration date, in the sense that they're over on January 20th when a much friendlier president of Vladimir Putin is sworn in. And then it would seem to me to be madness on Putin's part – and he does not seem to be mad, though he's many other things – to – you know, continue with a confrontation when he is, you know, someone's hand, you know, Trump staying there with an olive branch, desperately trying to be his friend, and how much more he can get on the world stage from this notion that the American president has decided against all evidence that somehow he is a workable partner in helping to take things off of America's agenda so that he can focus on other things. You know, Putin already decided not to retaliate to the expulsion of the diplomat. So he could certainly decide not to retaliate, because he's got a much longer game in mind about his own interests and Russia's interests and keeping America quiescent and friendly.
I agree. I mean, I think he will challenge Trump in the sense that he's going to try to get the best of whatever deal Trump thinks he's working out with him. But that's also a long game issue. I don't think he's going to retaliate directly for this in the Trump years.
Well, it's not as though the White House is going to be directing day-to-day operations in the event that they inherit a cyber war against Russia. It will be DOD. And DOD will be exacting these out, you know, daily operations. They will be deploying. They will be responsible for deploying conventional forces along the front, as it were, as well as, you know, these ongoing operations against Russia. So it's not as what I'm anticipating, and I could be wrong, is that Donald Trump will inherit a campaign of which he's not entirely aware of all the aspects to it. And so, sure, Putin can say, you know, we're not going to respond to this, that, or the other thing, but how much, you know, can you defer reciprocity to ongoing hostilities?
Well, there's no way of knowing that, and we shouldn't, you know, we're not going to know what we're doing, and they'll only know what they're doing. And the one thing about Trump that you know is he wants to be friends with Putin, and the one thing the administration will know as he comes in is that he wants to be friendly with Putin. And the one thing that Jim Mattis will know when he's sworn in, you know, when he presumably is confirmed really quickly in the first week of the administration, so they can go over and take over the Department of Defense, is that his new boss doesn't want to be in a cyber war with Russia, and that he can sort of declare it ended. I don't think that's that hard.
Well, if Moscow's learned anything from the last three resets, we had a reset with Russia in 2001, we had a reset with Russia in 2008, we're about to have another reset with Russia, is that they have a really limited window before conflict occurs. I mean, it's sort of inevitable that it'll occur because American-Russian interests conflict inherently.
One hopes. I mean, one doesn't hope that we're in a conflict, but one hopes that
these natural
Putin's, you know, that the war, you know, that the truth of the situation will educate the new president. But we don't know that that is the case. Now, the other major thing that happened is when we were gone, was this shocking act at the UN of abstaining on a resolution effectively declaring that the Jewish state has no sovereignty over East Jerusalem, and that the settlements are, all settlements are illegal, thus potentially placing Israelis at, in legal jeopardy all over the world if they, if they're from the settlements or in other ways, and if they live in Jerusalem across the Green Line, as it's called. My take on this, which I haven't been able to write for the magazine because we were away on vacation, is that in fact it was, if you remember, somebody told Jeffrey Goldberg of The Atlantic a couple of years ago that Bibi Netanyahu was a chicken blank. And I believe that the truth of the situation is that Obama is a chicken blank. If he really wanted to go out kicking Israel in the shins, he could have voted with the resolution, could have voted for the resolution. Abstaining on the resolution is no different from voting. You know, not either you veto or you vote. Abstain doesn't mean anything. It was a 14-0 vote with an abstention in the Security Council. If he meant it, then he should have done it and then taken his lumps for it instead of pretending that he didn't do it, but he did it, but he didn't do it, but he's a friend of Israel, but he's not, but he wants to, it's tough love, and he's sending a message, and he's not sending a message. And they tried so hard, as Ben Rhodes said. It was Bibi Netanyahu's fault that we got to this point, which is itself totally insane, since Bibi Netanyahu froze settlement activity at, you know, him unilaterally in Israel. It's sort of in an effort to try to make nice with the administration, and then John Kerry delivering this, you know, completely illogical, ahistorical and factually inaccurate address about the nature of the problems between Israel and the Palestinians, which to my absolute shock is eviscerated in a really stunning fact-check piece in the Washington Post today by Glenn Kessler, their fact-checker, who spent a very long time going through it and systematically takes Kerry's argument apart piece by piece, brick by brick, which we've done on the blog, other people have done, but it's sort of interesting to see it from somebody who obviously came at it without a predisposed wish to find what he found. I commend this piece to you very heartily. So the question there is, if emotionally, if he's trying to settle these fait accompli, this was something else. This was an emotional knee-jerk reaction to an issue that Obama himself has been too cowardly to face head-to-head, which is that he doesn't like Israel, he doesn't like the settlements, he doesn't like Bibi, he doesn't like the way Bibi handles him and treats him, and he was going to go out giving Bibi the finger.
Especially considering he never got the best of any exchange between them. He wasn't able to knock Bibi off in the election. He wasn't able to halt his progress in ingratiating himself to various new allies and quasi-allies. So this was his last.
And to support, Noah, your point about the tawdriness of the transition, there were suggestions off the record or on background suggestions that it was Donald Trump's appointment of David Friedman as the new ambassador to Israel that helped spur this decision. In other words, that because Trump had picked, you know, essentially a right-wing supporter of settlement activity and an opponent of the two-state solution to be America's new ambassador, that it was therefore even more incumbent on him to take this step to kind of show that America, that there were other opinions about this than were going to be expressed in the new administration, which is really kind of barbaric if you think about it, like to do that. So again, do it when voters actually are in a position to judge whether or not what you have done is fair or unfair, whether or not your party should or should not take the stand. Remember, in the United States, despite the fact that Democratic numbers are going way down, you know, this is the country, 61-62% of the people in the United States support Israel, and something like 9-10% support the Palestinians if you ask them who they like and whom they don't like. And so Obama doing this is not only a sort of slap in the face of Trump, it's also a slap in the face of American public opinion. And he's totally happy to do that as long as he doesn't have to pay for it.
And even if his party does have to pay for it.
Well, eventually, maybe it will, maybe it won't. It happens, you know, well before any subsequent election.
Right. But it also speaks against this idea of Obama as this sort of cool, pragmatic, always calm, perfectly easygoing.
He's a Vulcan.
Yeah, he's a Vulcan. Right. Yeah. Professor, you know, if he acts out in this fit of pique on the way out, that could damage the future of his party. That's not.
That's always been the bizarre myth of this White House, one which surrounded itself from the beginning with sycophants. You had one of the. It's such a layup that I couldn't even take a swing at it. I just wanted to let it sit there. Was Valerie Jarrett over the weekend saying Obama prides himself on one thing above all, and that is having not embarrassed himself in this White House. And to that, I submit the candid interview he gave with a woman who is famous for bathing in cereal, among other interesting highlights.
Yes, the YouTube celebrity, right, yes. Well, I mean, he didn't bathe in cereal, so he's at least got that going for him.
Yes, well, you know, small favors, I suppose.
But by the way, you know, this is the other thing about this whole conversation about Trump being the reality TV star. He's brought, you know, our culture has been so lowered that, you know, now we can have this guy who was was on World Wrestling, and then he had a reality TV show, and this is, he comes down the escalator, you know, with his, you know, with his Slovenian model wife, and lives in this garish apartment and all of that. And had it not been for 8 years of Obama going on Jon Stewart and going on John Oliver and going on this and talking and going, being between two ferns with Zach Galifianakis and being interviewed by the lady with the cereal and all of that,
news.
Slow jamming the news with Jimmy Fallon. And if he hadn't made himself into a TV star president, the notion that being a TV star president would be problematic, you know, that could have been used against Donald Trump. But the world had, you know, basically gotten so used to seeing Barack Obama on every talk show being, you know, having his feet massaged by every host, kind of lowered the bar there for the notion that it's unseemly for us to have a reality TV president. This is, even though Michelle hasn't participated that much and his kids haven't participated that much, he has he took out all the stops to basically make himself a TV accessible president.
Internet
accessible president.
A very famous Republican anti-Obama ad in 2008, celebrity, was mocked and impugned for its lack of efficacy. It was a complete whiff. And it turns out that that's the double-edged sword. It goes both ways. Right. You can be a celebrity president.
And look, he's going out with a very high approval rating. People like their celebrity president. More people like him than like Donald Trump, as it happens. And the question that we have to wonder at now is what he's going to do with that celebrity after he's gone. You know, we had the example in 2009 of George W. Bush deciding to remain silent almost entirely silent during the Obama years. But in 2009, as the Republican Party at its lowest ebb in 35 years, was trying to figure out how to handle the sort of onslaught from Obama, and some of the Tea Party stuff started happening and all that, if you remember, it was Dick Cheney, not George W. Bush, who came out and started speaking out very plainly and hard about what Obama was doing in American foreign policy. And there was all this, this is unprecedented, and look at this, and it's so unprecedented. But Cheney was very resolute. His rhetoric was very strong. It was very serious. He took this at a high level. And, you know, Obama could do that to Trump very easily, very early on. He could sort of become the leading opposition figure to Trump if that's what he wants to do with his post-presidency. I mean, it seems to me that it's like a fool's errand to do that, because what does he really get out of it, and what can he do with it if he does it, as opposed to making more of his post-presidency than that? But he certainly could be that figure, and there's clearly no figure of comparable weight in the Democratic Party. They don't have a House Speaker. They don't have a Senate Majority Leader. They don't have anybody to stand up. Bob Dole became the presidential nominee in 1996 for the Republican Party because the Republicans took the Senate in 1994, and he and Gingrich Jørgensen blowing himself up by whining about being on the plane, you know, being put in the back of the plane. But there were these two figures, serious national figures, who could you know, contest with Bill Clinton, and it really elevated Dole. And I don't know that there will be anybody who will be of that stature to go after Trump.
Well, I mean, I certainly don't think Obama is. I think he's very unlike George W. Bush in that he doesn't plan on staying quiet and sort of, you know, drifting off and becoming a memory while his successor is in office. I think the question is, though, is he wants to get the most out of his post presidency? Is that how he thinks he's going to get it? He also has. I think he has a lot of ideas about how he could set the Democratic Party right as well. You know, he seems to want to correct them.
Well, you know, there. I'll give you an interesting counterexample or model, which is Walter Cronkite. Sounds like a weird model, but you know, when Walter Cronkite retired from his perch as the, you know, as America's anchorman in I think 1981 or 1982, and he was finally done being the stentorian voice of reason, and basically he just came out as an out and out leftist. You know, for 10 or 12 years and just attacking everything from the left, having been mostly careful about that during his time behind the anchor's desk. Well, the question about Obama is, you know, he spent his life calibrating his words and being so careful about where he was ideologically, very much on the left, but he never said anything. His rhetoric was never something that you could, like, latch onto and say, oh my God, look, he said this, he can never be president, or that's so irresponsible, or something like that. Well, you know, 55 years old, he's out of the presidency, he can say whatever he wants, he can do whatever he wants. Will he be liberated to express himself in a way that he has never expressed himself before?
He's more or less said he plans on that. I mean, when in a recent interview with Doris Kearns Goodwin, he said, there are things that I can do. I think I can be more effective for certain causes when I'm unconstrained by the presidency. Certain things you can't do given the office, you know. And I believe him. I believe that's what he wants to do.
So why wouldn't that backfire for the people he's trying to reach? I mean, why wouldn't the progressive left hear a progressive, undiluted progressive message out of Barack Obama and say, where were you for the last 8 years?
Because that's not the way people do it. They would be so happy to have him as a tribune, particularly as they feel disempowered and alone and in a country that is, you know, veering toward soft fascism, that the, you know, most popular post-president should actually be in their camp and helping them along. I think they would be very thrilled.
I suppose you're right there that there will be support sort of on a superficial level, but I can't imagine that actually advances the cause.
They all loved Clinton. Nobody complained about Clinton.
Yeah, but the Democratic Party needs a serious rebuilding effort. The Democratic Party is decimated.
You know that.
Barack Obama said that he wants to help rebuild the farm team, right, that he oversaw the decimation thereof. So if he goes out there and starts talking like a, you know, revanchist progressive, then how much is his cause going to be advanced?
Well, you're now arguing two different points, which is you're saying that progressives will reject him for not being progressive enough, and then you're saying if he's too progressive, then he won't help the Democratic Party. I'm saying he'll do liberates himself, he'll do whatever he wants. Now, the most interesting question for me in his post-presidency is this. I know I'm not allowed to say this because I'm a conservative, but he happens to be a very good writer. Dreams for My Father is a very good book. Audacity of Hope isn't. I don't really think he wrote it. He did write Dreams for My Father despite this nonsense idea that Bill Ayers wrote it, since Bill Ayers never wrote anything good in his life. It's a good book. He could, if he really set his mind to it and focused and wanted to do this, produce a classic presidential memoir. First guy in a long time who could really produce a classic presidential memoir. And if he were honest enough to be able to talk about where he might have gone wrong and what happened to his party and all, you know, assuming that he has the self-knowledge to be able to describe that, even if he described it in a way that we would disagree with, he could really produce a book for the ages. It will be a test of his character, his focus, and his independence of thought, whether he will actually do that. And I don't know whether he will or not. I would say the odds are against it, but he will get $25 million. He'll get a $25 billion advance, and the book will sell 2, 3, 4 million copies. Bush's book, when he was at the nadir of his popularity, Bush's book Decision Point sold 2.5 million copies. So it's not like it's not a safe bet. And it's also a safe bet that we're done with this podcast, Commentary Magazine, the in its 72nd year as America's foremost monthly of intellectual, analytical, cultural, and policy analysis. Please join us at CommentaryMagazine.com. You get some free reads, and then we ask you to pay $19.95 for a year's digital subscription and $29.95 for an all-access subscription, including our iPad and our beautiful monthly magazine delivered to your mailbox. For podcast listeners today, go to CommentaryMagazine.com, click on subscribe, enter the coupon code 2017, and you will get, instead of $19.95, $14.95 for a digital subscription and $24.95 instead of $29.95 for an all-access subscription. So please join us. For Abe Greenwald and Noah Rothman, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.